Some of you may know this. I grew up in a household where health insurance is very important because my father opened up his own brokerage in Fairfield back in the mid-90s, and it's continued to expand. He helps people in the individual market and in the group market, and he now has employed for several years now my older brother, my husband, and my future brother-in-law, who are all partners at the brokerage there. And last week, you know, we talk a lot about some of the changes that are coming up because open enrollment is incredibly stressful for these guys. Anybody who works in health insurance, they'll tell you this is like basically their hell stretch from November until, you know, mid-February for sure. And I learned of something. I couldn't go public with it until other clients knew about it. And now that it's out there, I wanted to make sure you certainly knew what was coming before open enrollment starts on November 1st. So my father's brokerage, it's called Macman Insurance. It's in Fairfield, as I mentioned. And joining me now happens to be someone I'm very familiar with. My husband, Derek, is here because according to my father, he is kind of like the expert when it comes to new plans or updated plans every open enrollment period. His official title, though, is VP of Business Development at Macman. So good morning, honey. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. So I first want to just start very, very basic, if you don't mind. Do you mind actually just explaining the exchange, like what exactly that is for people who find health insurance in general to be incredibly complicated?
Yeah, so the exchange was created when they passed the Affordable Care Act. A lot of people will refer to it as Obamacare. Just to keep it general and specific to what people care about, it's really what the place that people would go for insurance if you're not getting it through an employer. It's a place that folks can get guaranteed issue insurance so you don't have to worry about any kind of pre-existing conditions. And the rates typically are just based on age. Here in Connecticut, it's also based on county. And it's the only place you can go to use your income and get a subsidized rate based on that projected income.
If you don't mind sharing with us as well, Derek, in recent years, Connecticut has lost a lot of carriers. I think we're down to, what, two now?
Yeah, so at this point, not a ton of competition, which is driving a lot of bad outcomes, to be blunt. We used to have five different carriers. It used to be Aetna, United, a company called Healthy CT, which is now no longer in business, ConnectiCare, and Anthem Blue Cross. And in 2016, going into 17, that's when it really dropped down to what it is now, which is ConnectiCare and Anthem Blue Cross. And the options just, you know, because of the lack of carriers, the options have just gotten more expensive over time. And this year in particular, there's going to be a lot of changes to the network.
So let's talk about it, because when you came home last week and you told me what ConnectiCare was changing for this upcoming enrollment period, I know for myself immediately, I think I've been bugging you for at least the last week. Somebody had to come on to talk about this, because to me, this is a bombshell announcement. What has ConnectiCare decided to do?
Yeah, so I think it's important too, just to realize that for years when Obamacare first started, people thought that to go onto the exchange and get, you know, a subsidized rate using your income, you'd have to be in a fairly low income bracket. And then during COVID, one of the, I guess, positive things that came out of it was they passed this American Rescue Plan Act, and it made it so folks that are in a quote-unquote higher income bracket could now go to the exchange and get a subsidized rate. It used to be that as an example, as a single tax filer under the old rules, you'd have to make like $50,000 or less to get any kind of help. And when they passed that American Rescue Act back in 2021, I had single tax filers making close to $100,000 or more, and they were still getting some kind of tax credit. So essentially back in 2021, when that law was passed, the exchange became a lot more of a good option for folks, even if you did have a higher income. So after that, after 2021, going into 2022, ConnectiCare then took their plans and they created this network called their Flex Network. Technically, it was already around on their employer-based plans, but they brought it to the exchange. So now you're talking folks getting a subsidized rate and an option for a national network. That's a big deal, especially for some of our clients that live in Fairfield County. They want access to New York. Maybe they have kids in college, you know, in different states where they need the kid to have a network where they're at in school. So 2022 and 2023, these plans with ConnectiCare, called their Flex plans, have been very popular. You can get a subsidized national plan. It's kind of a no-brainer if you don't have the luxury of getting insurance through work.
Mm-hmm. But so, what's going on with the Flex plans now?
So, yeah, so now for next year, ConnectiCare is completely getting rid of the Flex national network. So
if you're a ConnectiCare, like if you're insured with ConnectiCare, it means that you now don't have that national network.
Correct. So as of January 1st, there's going to be legitimately no options on the exchange that have that national network. ConnectiCare and Anthem Blue Cross will still be offering plans, but any plan on the exchange is going to be a Connecticut-only network with only emergency coverage outside of the state.
What does that mean, emergency coverage outside? Like, what does that mean?
Yeah, so it used to be a pretty loose term. Used to be meaning years and years ago, where as long as you just went to the emergency room, a carrier would typically approve it. We've seen over the past half decade that when I say emergency, I mean that it has to be a life-threatening, you know, you were in a car accident, you severely broke a limb, something along those lines to have any kind of out-of-state coverage. So you would no longer be able to proactively want to go see a doctor in New York or anywhere outside of Connecticut.
That's why I ask, like, emergency. So for people especially who want to get cancer treatments done at the best hospitals, which happen to be in New York or Boston, it's not going to cover it.
Exactly, yeah. So it's really, in a way, I mean, it was great to have the option for a couple of years, but it's kind of, you know, it's a very brutal awakening for a lot of our, especially folks in Fairfield County that live, you know, some folks in Stamford live only a couple miles away from the border, and no longer having that New York access it's a big deal.
I was thinking about this during the commercial break, actually. Do you all remember earlier in September when we learned officially that the cost of Connecticut individual and small group health plans are going to rise again in 2024? As if that wasn't going to be infuriating enough, we just learned that if you're a ConnectiCare user and you are used to those Flex plans, which allow you a national database to be able to use doctors or hospitals in network across the country, that's going to go away in 2024. And so the question is, what options do people have, especially if they want that national network, and how much is it going to cost them? So my husband, Derek, is one of the partners over at MacMan Insurance. That's my dad's health insurance brokerage in Fairfield. He's had it since the mid-90s. He's one of the probably the most well-known broker in Fairfield County, also probably one of the most successful ones in Connecticut. So my husband really studies these plans every time they go into an open enrollment period, and my father feels that he is like the expert when it comes to these new plans or these updated plans. He's the VP of business development. So what are people's options, Derek? Like, what do you do, especially if you, again, going back to the example of you've got a client who has cancer treatments and they only want to go to Sloan Kettering? What do they do?
Yeah. So, you know, not to be a Debbie Downer, I suppose that's the whole purpose of this segment with me, but I can run through a couple of examples that I put together for you of there's still going to be a ConnectiCare plan called their solo plans that will give you access to New York through their parent company Emblem Health. I did just want to call out, though, that the Flex plans going away is more impactful than just me stating that they're going away. There are some specific Flex plans that if you're in them and you do nothing, you won't even be renewed into a plan. So it's important to know that. If you're in a Flex Platinum plan with ConnectiCare, which was the very best plan on the exchange last year and the year before that, it's going away entirely. So you're going to get mailings from ConnectiCare and Access Health to let you know this, but if you do nothing, you're not going to have insurance as of January 1st. So it's super important that people know that. If you're in a Flex Silver plan, all the plans are categorized by metal tiers. So if you're in a Flex Silver plan, you're going to be mapped into a Connecticut-only network version of that plan. So at least you'll be in something similar, albeit with a smaller network. And then any other Flex Bronze and Gold plan members, they're going to be mapped into this new network that Connecticut is launching called a Value Network. And that term value is comical in a dark way because it does not have Yale or any of the subsidiaries Yale owns as in network. So again,
are you kidding? We only have like four major hospital networks, so no Yale hospitals are included on that network. Cool.
Exactly. It's terrible. And if you're in that Flex Bronze plan and you see your renewal notice and say, hey, if I don't do anything, at least they'll put me into this plan that looks pretty similar. It's called Value. I don't know what that means, but at least it'll be pretty similar. And at the end of the day, yes, it's a similar plan, but the network is very, very restrictive. And if you don't have Yale, I don't really know what the purpose of having insurance is here in Connecticut, because they own just about everyone. So yeah, I just wanted to call that out. Going back to your question about folks that need New York, again, Connecticut will have plans called Solo. That'll give access to their parent company, Emblem Health, which is their prime network. That does give Sloan Kettering, that gives HSS, Mount Sinai, Columbia, Presbyterian, all the big hospitals. But the big thing to know is that the solo plans are outside of the exchange. So in more simple terms, you cannot get a subsidy on the solo plans.
Do I dare ask how much that would be on average?
Yeah,
so, do I dare ask you that?
Right, yeah. I'm just going to keep giving the bad news.
Yeah.
So I did run some numbers just as a point of reference. So let's just say right now you're a 50-year-old, you're making about $100,000, and you're on the exchange on a high-deductible bronze plan. So 50 years old, making $100,000, but getting a Flex, so the National Network Bronze Plan, right now, you'd be paying $623 a month, which is already ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Next year, same 50-year-old, let's just say they haven't turned 51, they have to go to solo now, so they can't get any kind of income-related subsidy, and they need that New York access. They're going to pay over $1,000 a month.
That's insane.
For a solo plan.
That's absolutely insane.
You're talking over $400 more. If you took a married couple, so let's say two 50-year-olds, right now they're on the exchange. Let's say they both make $100,000, so they're at $200,000 in income, and they're getting the Flex Bronze plan. They're paying about $1,250 a month. If they go to the solo plan, which, again, no income-related subsidies, they're paying over $2,000 a month.
Wow. It makes me wonder, and I know you can't really answer this, and again, this is a PSA to anybody who's working with a broker during open enrollment. Please be kind to them. They're just the messengers. They're not the ones making these rates or these changes. But it does make me wonder, and maybe it's worth me talking to the state about this, if these carriers knew that these major changes were coming before they went and asked for a raise again this year. Like, I wonder if Connecticut knew they were going to pull the rug out. But they're still getting an increase this year, in their rates. I just it makes me wonder, and maybe that's the cynical side of me, but that's insane. That's insane. So they're seeing a rate increase, but at the same time, they're offering so much less for people. It's just – it's horrible. It's awful.
Yeah, the worst part about it, I mean, obviously, you know, these are private companies that do have some oversight but are kind of, you know, ultimately doing what they want. But the real issue is that there's just no competition. So, mm-hmm. like, if Connecticut comes out and does this and they increase their rates, they reduce their network, it's like, well, what else can I do? Because I could go to Anthem Blue Cross, but they're generally more expensive, and they have the same Connecticut-only network.
Mm-hmm.
Not the same network, but the same restrictions of Connecticut-only. So, you know, there has to be more done to bring in more competition. Otherwise, this market's just going to keep getting worse and worse, not to be overly negative. But yeah, you're right. So
it's just being realistic. And I think certainly the big takeaway is absolutely work with your brokers, whoever that may be. Certainly work with your brokers before open enrollment. You're going to want to more than ever before because some major changes are coming. But also be patient with your brokers. I just know from being married to one that they are as patient as they possibly can be, but they are not the ones who created these rates and created these changes. So please be patient with them. And, you know, if you need to take your frustration out on someone, make it like your pillow or something, but not your broker, because they are doing the best they can to just make sure you and your family are enrolled. But this is certainly, like I mentioned, a bombshell announcement ahead of open enrollment starting on November 1st. And I thank you, Derek, who typically is never like a Debbie Downer ever. He's just doing his job. He's the messenger. So don't shoot the messenger, especially because this one is my husband. Thank you, Derek. I appreciate you and I love you.
I love you, too. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Of course. And again, open enrollment is starting on November 1st. So these are some major, major changes. And if you heard any of the plans that Derek just mentioned and you thought, I'm enrolled in that, this is going to impact me or my family, it's definitely worth the call even before open enrollment starts. Start figuring out what your plan is going to be. Do it sooner rather than later. It was 1 week ago that New York was celebrating the discovery of a 9-year-old girl, and they arrested a 47-year-old man charged with kidnapping her, Charlotte Senna, who is safe now after she was out camping with her family on vacation and she was taken. And luckily, 2 days later, police were able to find her. But a lot of times, abduction or kidnapping cases do not end that quickly and with that amazing happy ending. So we wanted to talk to Gary McNamara, who is one of our law enforcement experts on the show, somebody we like to go to about some of these national stories and how they apply to us here in Connecticut. And Gary is the former chief of police at the Fairfield Police Department. He currently does security and governmental affairs over at Sacred Heart University, joining us now to give us some perspective. Hey, Gary, how are you?
I am well, Melissa. Good morning.
Good morning. So first of all, were you shocked at how quickly police were able to find this girl unharmed?
Yeah, very much so. In cases like that, especially stranger abductions, they usually do not end in a positive outcome. So for them to find her so quickly, and now, you know, we're getting more information as to why, but to find her so quickly is certainly a thankful thing.
I know after this story hit the news waves, I know a lot of people here in Connecticut, it sort of hit them in a really raw spot because they thought of Vanessa Morales, the Ansonia toddler, who's not so much a toddler anymore. I think she's about Chase's age, actually. So she's now a little kid, but she has been missing now for years. And, you know, she is believed to be alive, but no trace of where she could have gone after the murder of her mother. And so a lot of people in Connecticut feel like this is way too close for comfort. And like you said, Gary, it's not usually heard of that you have, first of all, a quick find. And then when you do find somebody in a quick turnaround, that they are in good condition. It sounds like that doesn't happen very often. So you can imagine, Gary, a lot of people are talking about this. They want to keep their kids safe. What are some of the most common things that kids should know to make sure that they can avoid being, well, can't help if they're a target, but avoid being taken?
Wow, that's a lot to it. You know, I think the key is that, you know, just because the location changes doesn't necessarily mean that the threat changes.
Oh, I love
so
that.
Always,
that's,
you know,
so true. Yes.
It is. And you know, when you know, we hyper-focus on being home or walking to and from school or something that they're familiar with, and then their guard is down. You know, you go to a campsite, and that's the fun of going to a campsite. You can ride late at night. You can go with your friends. You can go out where normally you wouldn't do that. So location is key. So that means that you never have your guard down. And we don't want our kids to be so hyper-focused and fearful that they're crippled and can't do anything. But at the same time, as parents, we have to understand that just because a location changed, the threat does not. It's always there. And these are rare. I mean, you know, yearly there's probably under 350 kids a year under 17 that are abducted by someone they don't know. So they are rare cases, but location is important. And then we've talked about it before, Melissa, the stranger danger thing isn't really good anymore. Because number one, the threat could be somebody they know or they see. Now, this individual, we learned, had a house near where the family lived. Now, I don't know whether they knew each other. He certainly, it appears, knew the family before this occurred.
Mm-hmm.
But that means the girl may have seen the individual in the neighborhood at one point or at the store. So it's not really a stranger. So stranger danger doesn't necessarily, while maybe a little effective, we want to make sure we reframe that. And then you want them to always try to understand how a person's going to come to you. Generally, they don't approach kids. Well, some can, where they open up a door of a van and they just grab the kid and run away. Most of the time, it's through a ruse or something that they say to them or how they approach the child. So you want to share with the kids what that could look like. But at the same time, you want to really go back to the fact that no adult should ever approach you. So you, no matter where you are, no adult should ever approach you. And that's the message we want to kind of come across. And then you want to give them tools on what to do if they do.
Yeah, we're certainly going to go through some of those tools. I was thinking about, Gary, you know, like, I love a couple of things you said. First of all, location is key. That goes for actually a lot of different things. My son, unfortunately, is kind of a very easy target. He's just like a very simple, kind soul. And so he has had his bout of just kids picking on him or whatever. And it's interesting because my husband and I have worked very hard with our son to try and give him mechanisms to stand up for himself but never get physically involved with things that he should say. And so he has started to practice that, and he's finding success like in kindergarten right now. But what's interesting is over the weekend, he was in a very, I would say, unfamiliar or new territory. He was away for a day trip with my parents, and he came across a kid who was just kind of messing with him, nothing bad, but he froze. He had no idea what to do. And when he came home, we said, well, why don't you do what you do in school? He said, well, I wasn't in school, so I didn't even think that would apply. So it is interesting to have that conversation of like, hey, we've talked about this. This applies everywhere. If you're ever going through instead of looking at, okay, when you're here or when you're dealing with this person, like generalize it, broaden it so that kids know they should use those tactics always. But, you know, the other thing, like you were saying, Gary, is that you should always just know that you shouldn't be approached. Did you hear that story in upstate Connecticut last week where the girl was just walking home or walking away from her house and the guy wanted to take her shopping and she ran into a Dunkin' Donuts, thank God? I mean, what a smart 11-year-old, because just that, like, she knew, stop talking to me. Like, why are you coming up to me? That idea of, like, I shouldn't be approached by anybody, that's so important.
It is, and you mentioned about being out of location. That's why generally police won't train on a specific location. Because if we trained on one house, we're going to get really good at doing this in this intersection. You want to train for no matter where the incident is, the steps and the tactics are always going to be the same. I can manage a street corner if I'm always training on that street corner. I don't want that. I want to manage anywhere. I want to manage the incident, not the location. The location has some dynamics that you have to be aware of, such as if you're camping and you're driving around and you have a little more leeway, but you always want to employ the tactics no matter what the location is. So that's really key, and that's a good example of it. You're not in school, so why should I be doing what I do in school?
When you look at national statistics, it says every 40 seconds a child goes missing or is abducted in the United States. Approximately 840,000 children are reported missing every year, and the FBI estimates that's between 85 and 90% of the people who go missing are children. Now, I do want to also make note with those statistics that you'll see it pretty often in the news. I don't usually put it in my news unless police directly come to me and say, hey, we're actually really concerned about this. You'll have kids reported missing all the time, but then they're found a couple days later because they're upset with their parents or they ran off with a boyfriend or something like that. I'm not condoning the situation, but those cases do also get factored in with those really high numbers. Regardless, many, many people are very worried about child abductions, especially after what we saw happen in New York, even several years ago right here in Connecticut, what's still going on with Ansonia's Vanessa Morales, who is still missing. And so we have Gary McNamara here, and he is one of our law enforcement experts on the morning show. He's the former chief of police in Fairfield. He's also he's currently involved with Sacred Heart University. He is in charge of security and governmental affairs there. So, Gary, I've been noticing a lot of viral videos, especially on social media, of kids being taught by their parents how to get out of trunks, the trunk of a car. That's something I've seen a lot of. And I was curious if you feel like families are maybe going too far. I mean, are these things that, you know, you feel like I'm doing everything I can to get my kid out of a situation? Or do you feel like that's just going to scare them and there are better ways to make sure they are prepared before they get to that point?
Yeah, Melissa, there's a good quote from the 1894, I think, and it says, "Fear is the mother of all safety."
Mm.
And so what it basically is telling us is that safety is born from fear. And however, I mean, it's the weight of fear. You know, how much fear do you say? There's a reason we don't go to if we see a bee's nest, we don't go up to it.
Right.
Because somewhere along the line, we either got stung and we're afraid of it, or our parents or somebody said, don't go near it because they sting. So there's an important level of fear that we have to share so that we can become safe from it. If you're not afraid of something, you're not going to feel safe from it. So I think, you know, that's a key component of it. We have to kind of, respectable fear, I think, is what we have to teach. Now, how you teach it is obviously dependent upon the child and how they can accept it. And how you deliver it is certainly important as well. You know, I think that parents have they have to be hyper-focused on it. They have to continually talk about it, but I think it's in the way that they talk about it.
Mm. The other thing too, Gary, is I'm noticing, and I get this, we have devices where you could track your kids, and it's not the cell phone, though, that I'm talking about. For younger children especially, you know, kids under the age of 10, I'll say, I have noticed, having a kindergartner, how many parents are utilizing AirTags, whether it's on the kids' backpacks, whether these parents are clipping it to the belt buckle of their kids' pants, whether they've made necklaces out of AirTags. And part of me totally gets it. Part of me is like, that would be that's certainly like a peace of mind for you as the parent. But I'm also wondering, like, is it now instilling a fear every day or a focus on something every day for you and your child? Is it going too far? I was curious from your professional perspective what you think about that.
Well, so look, if this girl had that on her, they would have found her quicker. They would have been able to discover where she was. So that's we have to go under that understanding. The problem with that is, number one, do you tell the child that I'm tracking you? And then the other thing, are you as a parent constantly tracking them and constantly worried, where are they, what are they doing? So I think all these tools and these techniques and things to keep kids safe, you have to weigh it against the hypervigilance and the disruption of the child and the parent, because you can find yourself now tracking every moment of the day. They're supposed to be home. They're 2 minutes late. Maybe they stopped, you know, to talk to a friend when they got off the bus. But it is technology to use. Some people put it on their car keys. So if you're going to put an AirTag on your car keys to find them, then, you know, the argument would be maybe you want them to have them on your child. I don't necessarily think you have to make a necklace and tell them what that is. And to go back to the trunk, getting out of a trunk, you know, Melissa, I want to know how to get out of a trunk.
Yeah.
You know, you open up the trunk, look at it. I want to know how to do that. So that's a conversation you can have. I can have it with you, you know, to open up the trunk. Hey, you know, this is if you ever get locked in the trunk. You don't have to say that if you ever get abducted and thrown in the trunk of a car by a bad person.
Right. That's so true.
But again, then you focus on what really matters. Grown people should never talk to you when you're walking anywhere. It doesn't matter. Always be with a friend, number one. Grown people shouldn't talk to you. If they do talk to you, let's practice how you would scream, how you would run, what you would do. That's what really matters. And then other conversations, just to teach kids practicing safety in a practical way without instilling that fear. By the way, kids get abducted. This is where you could be. What are you going to do if you get in a trunk? You know, they might put something over your mouth. How are you going to kick? You could teach them all these skills without necessarily encapsulating it into the bad person that abducts children.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you do it is you research on your own. You know, you Google up abductions, attempted abductions, and then periodically you can kind of have those discussions, like the one that the girl ran into Dunkin' Donuts, or the one recently where the van pulls over and the guy is threatening to poison the kids.
Mm-hmm. And grabby.
You know, you can have those conversations, but you have to have that baseline that your safety depends upon being aware, practicing these skills no matter where you're at, running and reporting to somebody quickly, no matter where you're at. And then all the other things that you instill in them, those other life skills that you instill in them, can all be incorporated back to that safety message. But I don't necessarily think you have to put it into one big fearful session that you have with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. And even like you said, Gary, being vulnerable yourselves, like I couldn't tell you how to get out of a trunk. But it is kind of like a learning thing that you as an adult could do as well. So they feel like, oh, me and mom learned how to do this together, or me and dad, you know, figured this out together. So it's also not coming from a very scary standpoint of like, I need to teach you this in case.
That's right.
You know, like it's like, hey, I actually realized like, you know, I get, you know, we get locked in the car. Like, what? How do we get out? Here's what we do.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a really, really good point. And Gary, these are great tips overall. Thank you so much for normalizing this conversation. I know it's not a very comfortable one for adults, but it's one certainly worth having in today's world. So thank you so much.
Melissa, thank you. Parents will be happy to have the conversation. They're difficult to have, but they're really, really important to have. So thanks for listening.
Absolutely. And again, Gary is the Chief and Executive Director of Public Safety and Government Affairs at Sacred Heart University right here on WICC. You know, I think these are some of the local stories that sometimes will get overlooked, but they're huge, impactful stories for our communities. So I saw this going into the weekend that Shelton is getting $2 million for its Canal Street reconstruction project. And if you don't live in Shelton especially, you may not even know what the Canal Street reconstruction needs are. So I wanted to get some more details on this. And joining us now is State Representative Jason Perillo, who can tell us a little bit about the history of Canal Street and why this reconstruction work is needed and what this $2 million is going to do. So Representative Perillo, thank you for joining the show. How are you?
I'm good, Melissa. Good morning.
I'm glad to have you here. First of all, tell us about Canal Street in Shelton. What is, I would say, the impact of it, or how much is it used, or how important is it to Shelton residents and business owners?
Well, Canal Street has over a 100-year history, and you know, for decades was the backbone of Shelton's downtown manufacturing and job creation. Of course, since that time, you know, Shelton and many towns have changed, and that manufacturing no longer exists. But what we've seen in the last 15 years on Canal Street is a tremendous renaissance when it comes to residential development, beautiful apartments, condominiums. So Canal Street has really become an anchor to downtown's success here in Shelton. That said, you know, there's always work to be done. So, you know, we've leveraged private dollars. We've leveraged, you know, federal and state money in the past to improve Canal Street. It is right on the river. It is right near the Housatonic Dam. But we've reached a point where, you know, we needed more resources to continue that work. You know, and that's where this money comes into play right now.
What specifically needs to be worked on for Canal Street?
Yeah, so many years ago, maybe 10 or so, there is a railroad crossing at what is called Worcester Street. You know, if you don't know Shelton, you don't know where that is, but trust me. Losing that crossing had a big impact on two things. First, it had an impact on traffic, you know, putting a lot of cars onto Howe Avenue. And second, it did impact emergency access. It was a really important way to get down to Canal Street, to those new residences for fire trucks, ambulances, and losing that crossing mattered. So we're at a point right now where we have an opportunity to reopen that crossing. It'll alleviate traffic downtown. It'll provide that emergency access, you know, that residents down there need. There are a number of projects already slated, residential projects, to be constructed. So this crossing really had to happen. There are a couple of other projects that go along with that. There's some lighting. There's some enhancements to the road, to Canal Street. So this crossing and the work that goes along with it really is, you know, it was the barrier to the next frontier of progress on Canal Street. But now that that funding is in place, you know, we're going to see those projects happen.
And I think I was reading in the news article that first alerted me to this money, Representative Perillo, something about creating open space. I don't remember if that was a quote from you or Senator Kelly, but certainly the historic preservation, as you mentioned, that was a big part. But I did see that there was a mention of creating open space. Would that be in or around Canal Street? Again, if you're not a Shelton resident, maybe hard to kind of envision. But could you talk maybe about, you know, the opportunity for open space as well?
This is actually a hidden gem in downtown Shelton. You know, as I mentioned before, This area is right near the Housatonic Dam. Now, when the Housatonic Dam was built over 100 years ago, locks were installed so that boats could travel from above the dam to below the dam and vice versa. Those locks still exist, and there is open space around those locks. It is a beautiful area right on the river with views of the dam. It is a tremendous historical location. I mean, where else are you going to be up close to, you know, old historical locks in such a beautiful spot? So, yes, the funding that goes along with this project will also pave the way literally, so that folks can actually get to this open space and really see, you know, what I think is one of the coolest things in downtown Shelton that most people don't even know exists.
That is really interesting. And again, we have Representative Jason Perillo here, and a huge announcement going into the weekend. Shelton getting $2 million for their Canal Street reconstruction work. And there are several uses for this money for Canal Street. Tell me, Representative Perillo, why do you think Shelton was recognized for this money? Why do you think the State Bond Commission approved money specifically for Shelton? I know that we have over 200 municipalities that I'm sure have reconstruction projects or things similar to that that they would like covered. Why do you think Shelton made it to this round of grants?
Yes, I think there are two answers to that question. First and foremost, it's a good project. It's about economic development. It's something that's ready to go. You know, the state has, you know, and the governor's office have clearly expressed an interest in funding economic development, you know, things that create jobs, things that create new residential opportunities, things that add, you know, money to, you know, taxable properties. So that's what this does. Secondly, Shelton has a track record of success when it comes to projects like this. You know, and honestly, a lot of credit goes to the city government, you know, what Mayor Loretti has done. When the state or the federal government gives money to the city of Shelton to execute a project, it gets executed, and it gets executed well. So it's nice that, you know, the state recognizes that. It's nice that they reward success. I think we need to see that. So putting some money into a Shelton project leverages private money. So, you know, this $2 million of state money is going to lead to tens of millions of dollars in private investment. So those are the kind of projects you want to fund. You know, government can't fund everything. And in this case, a little bit of government seed money creates an opportunity for private developers to spend their own money to make a community better and more vibrant. And like I said, you know, Shelton, Mayor Loretti, we have a track record to this.
Would you say, Representative Perillo, that the current state of Canal Street has impacted in a negative way businesses wanting to come into Shelton at all? Like, would this money also mean that we attract more businesses?
Well, I mean, you know, downtown is actually a great example. You know, we've seen a real resurgence in retail, especially, you know, restaurants. You know, businesses go to places where there are a captive audience. And typically what you see in downtown resurgence, whether it be in a small city like Shelton or a large city like Austin or Atlanta, you know, you bring residents in, you bring disposable income in to a downtown area, and then the businesses follow. Because you're not going to build a business if you don't have any customers. So that's what we're seeing here in Shelton. Many of these new residents are now patrons of the restaurants, of the businesses. So, you know, is this project going to bring in, you know, a business with 2,000 employees? No, but it's going to support these small businesses and create opportunities for these small businesses to thrive. And really, that's what, you know, Main Street America has really become all about. It's the small business owner who's putting their own money on the line. And this is one way that the city of Shelton can create opportunities for those businesses to thrive.
And last question, Representative Perillo, how soon can we see the reconstruction work come to a close?
You know, I don't even know the answer to that question. I wish I did. you know, these projects always take longer than I want. You know, a few years ago, you know, we obtained funding to improve the Derby Shelton Bridge, the Bridge Street Bridge. You know, that work is still going on. And I think they've been doing that for 3 years, and there's probably at least another year in it. So, you know, I'm done predicting when projects are going to be finished. I've been wrong almost every single time someone has asked on past projects. So we'll let the engineers and the construction folks figure that out. But hopefully sooner rather than later, because I know there are a lot of Shelton residents who want to get back to using that railroad crossing and enjoying Canal Street and that open space.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Representative Jason Perillo, I want to thank you for taking the time to come on and talk about the importance of this money and how Shelton, landed on the map for getting this money for reconstruction work. And certainly we'll watch to see how the project unfolds and what it will mean for the community. Thank you so much.
And Melissa, thanks a lot. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Again, we were chatting with Representative Jason Perillo and Shelton receiving $2 million for its Canal Street reconstruction work. Getting the details right here on WICC.